We are very disappointed that the views and opinions expressed by the participants of this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show.
County, California. I'm Zach Bertie. Welcome to AnCast. And joining me in the co-host chair is Gio Manry. Hey, Gio.
Hey, what's up?
Oh, lots of stuff. Lots of stuff is up. What a fun-filled week this has been.
Oh, yes.
So, obviously, we were the news. ANN was the news in this last week. And let me just say, if you're a news organization and you're the news, unless you want an award of some kind, it's bad.
Usually.
And it was certainly bad. Certainly bad what happened. Now, we're talking about this on Thursday evening, sort of after. It's basically been resolved. Our security was effed up. It got exploited. Someone leaked the second episode of My Little Sister Can't Be This Cute. And that totally fucked our simulcasting plans, or Chris and Justin's simulcasting plans, I should say. And that really sucked, and it was really crappy, especially on Saturday when it sort of broke, and I was just completely flabbergasted and suddenly quite depressed, because I know Chris has put a lot of work into it, and, you know, this is awful.
Well, of course, it was especially tough since both Chris and Justin, the people who actually knew things about it, were at New York Comic Con / Anime Fest, or whatever you want to call it, and couldn't really respond to it as quickly. And I think somebody said it was also a holiday in Japan, so it was sort of like this, the worst possible time anything could have happened.
It was, yeah. Monday was a holiday in Japan, a work holiday. And so nobody was going to be saying anything until after the fact. And it's my understanding that legally it was a bad idea for any sort of comment to be made, because they certainly weren't talking to me, and I wasn't asking questions, because I'm in the luxury position of my stock and trade is opinion and editorial, and I have nothing to do with news. So I recused myself from it. Not only that, it was Saturday, and I was busy with the preview guide, and I was burned out already, so I wasn't going to... It's Egan's job to start digging, and he did, and you did. But, you know, you got what you could. And the whole thing was just a big unfortunate mess. But it's been basically cleared up now. Chris took responsibility for it, and out it goes. I have no idea what the future is. I think we have a good idea of what happened at this point.
Although, actually, I was surprised when I asked Chris for the news article, and he said that actually he is expecting to have simulcasts in January, if not sooner. I mean, if this tells you anything about how much the news people and editorial people know about what's going on that side of things, I had no idea.
I don't know what's going on with that. And I prefer not to know what's going on with that.
Yeah.
I like to find out when everyone else finds out. And that way I can just be totally in my own little bubble. I like my bubble.
Exactly.
It's comfortable. You know, it's funny because there's a lot of philosophical arguments about this in terms of, like, who do you blame, the bank or the bank robber? And this was, from my understanding, based on the apology letter and then Chris's comments afterward, you know, security was compromised. It was bad security, but it was compromised. And so in my head, I sort of thought of this as, like, in anime fandom, we sort of exist in a reality where there is a Lex Luthor out there, and he has stated, I'm Lex Luthor, I'm going to fuck with you. If your security is not airtight, guess what? I'm going to get in there. Like, they stated that. And we knew that a year and a half ago when Funimation got that. When Funimation dealt with a similar problem.
One Piece.
These guys are out there. They exist. They've said, we're bank robbers. We're Lex Luthor. We're going to come after you. And so it's important to be really, really paranoid with your security and really, really crazy about making sure it's air fucking tight. And so that's the reality that we live in. And while, yeah, the people doing it are shitty, the people leaking episodes to the internet, they're shitty, but they told us they were going to be shitty. So it is just as much our responsibility to make sure that nothing is going to go wrong. And that's ultimately where the problem is here. So that's my personal take on it. It's that's the city that we live in. We live in a city that has a guy who has decided to be the villain. And so that's the reality. That's the world we live in. That's my take on it.
Yeah, sad but true.
That's just the internet for you. All right, moving on from there, because there's nothing more to say. I don't know any more than what's been stated. What's been stated seems pretty final to me. it sounds like it's a possibility that we're gonna do simulcasts again. And, you know, obviously we all pray and hope that this wouldn't ever happen again. But that's kind of where it sits right now. And, you know, if I ever find out more or know more, you know, you'll hear it from me. But let's talk about New York Anime Festival, because I didn't go. And I'm kind of glad I didn't go, based on the reports that I saw. How was it?
Crowded.
Yeah.
Oh, man. I mean, Friday wasn't so bad, but Saturday, it was kind of like being at San Diego. I heard that from everybody. It was not the same numbers, but everybody seemed crammed into much less space, and I know a lot of people were concerned that combining New York Comic Con and New York Anime Fest would mean anime would get shunted to the side, and Reed kept saying, no, that's not going to happen, but it kind of did, a little. The Artist's Alley and all of the anime panels and screenings were down in kind of the lower left basement, sort of away. It even, like, the Artist's Alley even had slightly different hours than the exhibit hall and things, which is kind of weird.
That's weird.
Everybody, as usual, was up in the exhibit hall. The Vertical was in small press, actually, but everybody else was in the main exhibit hall. And I think it was Jim Voles who said that if Otakon had had their aisles spaced that narrowly, they would have been in big trouble with the fire marshals.
Wow.
So if that tells you anything about how crowded it was pretty crazy.
Well, and then they usually shove New York Anime Festival into that little basement area. Like, that's usually where it is. And so that's where it was this time, right? Was it even smaller than usual?
No, it was the opposite end area from where it usually is.
Oh, okay.
So,
to the left.
But it's identical, relatively speaking. It had a little stage, which is where they did stuff. Oh, but the New York Anime Fest opening ceremonies were at this little stage upstairs in the same room as, like, small press and autographs. But it looked like just kind of a break area with a bunch of chairs and tables and things. Like, so I kind of walked by there. I'm like, this isn't where, oh god, there's a sign, this is opening ceremonies.
That is a little,
like,
ghetto.
Most people who were sitting there were not there for opening ceremonies. I don't think they even realized it was going on while it was going on.
Well, yeah, I mean, your report on it was like five sentences.
Yeah, because that's everything that happened. He introduced four of the guests, not all of them, just four, and they snipped the red ribbon and that was it.
Yeah.
Admittedly, I don't go to a lot of opening ceremonies, but it struck me as particularly short.
You know, in my 10 years of doing this, I have never once been to an opening ceremonies. It always just seems completely superfluous to me.
Yeah, actually, my first was when I went to the one at Otakon to report on. So that was my only experience with opening ceremonies, was this big, all the guests, the cool video by, was it IG this year? I forget, you know, all that stuff. And then New York Anime Fest are like, snip, done.
Well, there was a much larger convention happening at the same time.
Yeah. It was tricksy.
So overall, besides just being crowded, did you have a good time? Was the programming okay? Did everything sort of go off without a hitch?
Pretty much everything did. A couple panels started late for, you know, the usual sort of technical difficulties and things. I had a scary moment. I moderated the panel that in which Stan Lee and Yoshiki announced their motion comic project, and then moderated the Q&A with Yoshiki immediately following that. And when Yoshiki walked off the stage, there were a dozen or so fangirls. I have the sense they actually flew out from Japan for this,
mm-hmm.
who were literally flinging themselves at him and being held back by security. It was the scariest moment of my life.
Really?
Yeah, that was kind of, I guess I should have expected it. The man's sort of a rock god, but I didn't really think about it that much. I was too worried about screwing up.
Were there any 40-year-old guys doing that for Stan Lee?
No, they stood in the audience and they yelled a lot of stuff, but Stan left, 15 minutes into the thing. He didn't stay for the Yoshiki Q&A.
Yeah, I'm sure.
So, when he left, people got up and left who weren't interested in Yoshiki, but they left out the back. I didn't see anybody. That I know of throwing themselves at him, but yeah, it wouldn't surprise me. I'm sure it happened somewhere over the weekend.
I'm sure, yeah. That guy shows up to the opening of a paper bag, though, so it's not a huge deal when Stan Lee is at something.
That is very true.
So, in terms of what we got around to watching this week, you saw Star Driver, right?
I did. I watched the Star Driver first episode premiere at the convention. It was very, very shiny. It kind of reminded me a little bit of, like, the first episode of Code Geass, in that it kind of showed a lot of promise, and it was mechs, and it was nice art and cool designs and things, and you didn't really know where it was going to go. I would say it's a little sillier than Code Geass's first episode, which is not to say Geass did not have plenty of excessively silly episodes, but I'm looking forward to it. I enjoyed Code Geass too, so I guess the first season anyway. So
yeah, I'm curious about it. I'm curious about it because it was written by the same dude who wrote Utena, and that's an all-time favorite of mine. So I'm curious about it. It got premiered there. I assume somebody has a deal for it already, so I'm just going to wait, and inevitably somebody will put it out. I'll see it that way.
Yeah.
But that's why we only have the one preview in the preview guide as yours, because you're the only person who had access to it legally, but it was available somewhere legally. So, you know, we stick to those rules. But speaking of the preview guide, which is almost over, we've got like one show left. What stuck out for you this year? What was good?
Well, because of the convention and all sorts of just other stuff going on, I didn't get to as much as I usually do. My favorite, actually, I kind of like The World God Only Knows. Like, I kind of get the feeling it could be something that turns out kind of one single joke being done over and over again. And it did kind of weird me out that the result of the first episode is that the guys, like, training with visual novels sort of paid off with real women.
Mm-hmm.
But there's some potential there, depending on where they go with it. Guess what I'm not watching is Yosuke no Sora.
Oh, wow. God. Holy shit. You know,
wow.
that was released late at night, and usually during the preview guide, I am still working at 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, and that came out then. And when I'm the first person to get to a show, the rule for myself is I have to do it if no one else has done it yet. If I'm the first person who gets to it, I got that show. I clicked through. I watched like the first like 5 minutes of it. And said, well, I'm going to hate this. Like, I knew I was going to hate it. So I just started clicking through the episode. I'm like, I'm not going to review this. I'm just going to hate it. It's whatever. Somebody else can get to this. So I was clicking through the episode, and then I got to the end of the episode and was horrified and turned it off and said, yep, other people can handle this. I guess the deal is with this now, let's just not even take the porn out or the incest out. Let's just leave it all in.
Yeah, pretty much.
That seems to be the idea with that show, which, hey, okay,
well,
fine.
Just, you know, most of these harem kind of shows, regardless of what level of pornography there is, the characters all have at least one stupid character trait that they all cling to in an effort to distinguish them. And there was none of that in this. There were three different girls with dark hair who went to the school. They saw the new guy. Blushed furiously. I mean, they identical. I have no idea which one is which. Looking back at it, it was kind of appalling.
Yeah, that show is kind of like everything I don't like about anime in one show, about modern anime in one show.
Uh-huh.
The standout for me was Bakuman, which I enjoyed, despite the incredibly stupid ass ending of the first episode. I'm positive that somebody will put that out here, so I'm just going to wait. But I've heard it gets horrendously misogynistic, so we'll see.
Yeah, I've heard that a lot, too. I'm real curious to see how it goes.
I can totally see it going there, based on the end of that first episode. I was like, oh, that's why this is horribly misogynistic, because that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. So, yeah, I don't know, on Bakuman. But the thing I saw that totally fucking blew me away, and I loved it, and I watched it all in one sitting, was Eden of the East. Funimation put the Blu-rays out for that show, and I've been waiting for that show. I didn't watch it when the fan subs came out. I saw the premise, I saw like a trailer, and said, I think I'm gonna like this. Then the fan subs came out, and I was like, this is gonna get licensed. Funimation licensed it. So I finally got to see it, and man, what a show. I loved it. Loved it. Start to finish. And I loved the ending, too. I don't know why people are bitching about the ending. Have you seen the whole thing?
Yes.
Right. What did you think?
I loved Eden of the East. I absolutely dedicated it from start to finish. I actually was such a nerd that I like tricked out my phone to have some of the Jui's sound effects and stuff.
That's cool.
For a while there. the animation and the characters, I would never have expected the character designer of something like Honey and Clover to work on a show like this, but it worked so well. And I just, all the characters are really great without, you know, they're interesting, but they don't like overdo everybody's story at the same time, but they're not one notes. I mean, it's just a really solid show.
Yeah, it's really, really solid. And the premise, for people who don't know, is basically There are 12 of these magic phones that basically give you access to, they give you a billion, what is it, like 10 billion yen. You get 10 billion yen, so effectively unlimited funds. You get access to this computer that can make anything you want to happen happen. So, and then the purpose of having this phone is change the country for the better. Put Japan, fix Japan, put Japan back on track, which is a really great premise for a movie. And I'd be shocked if the, just the concept of that doesn't get picked up and made into an American film where there's this magic phone with a concierge that can make anything happen. You have $10 billion, change the world. Although in American dollars, it'd have to be like $1 trillion. You need a lot more.
Yeah, really.
You need a lot more. But so that's basically the premise. And it explores these themes of, you know, the nature of society, politics, power, all of these really great themes. And it explores them responsibly and in an interesting and thoughtful way. It's not irresponsible with its storytelling. The only thing I didn't like was I think they spent way too much time on the penis chopping crow lady thing. Once they introduced her character motivation, I was like, oh, I get it. You know, this is how she's planning on changing the world, which is replacing the weak Japanese male population with a strong international male population. Okay, I get what they're saying with this. And they spent like 2.5 episodes on it. In an 11 episode show, that's way too much. That was my only complaint. Other than that, the show was totally riveting and I loved the ending. And I kind of can't believe there's two movies. It doesn't need more. Like, I get they didn't wrap up absolutely everything, but by the end, the question of who Mr. Outside is and who the supporter is are sort of irrelevant. They're not irrelevant. They're just sort of like, well, it'd be interesting, but that's not what they were going for with the story here.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that ultimately wasn't really the point. The point was what Akira does with his power. And so I really liked the ending. And the guy from Colony Drop on Twitter, Botoggle, he said, the Eden of the East movies are the Matrix sequels.
And, oh, no.
Right, right. And having seen the end of Eden of the East, it's very much like the end of the first Matrix movie. No, we don't find out exactly how the Matrix was made or who's behind it, or he doesn't destroy the whole thing and he doesn't fix everything. It's just telling the story of this guy, and it's got, you know, a solid ending that doesn't answer all your questions, but it leaves you pondering. Not necessarily totally that I must know everything about what's happening here. So I don't know, maybe people just don't like endings that don't tell you absolutely everything, but I don't know. I really like
I can't remember who it was, but I was talking to somebody at one point who had a theory of fandom that what really establishes a fandom is not what is told in the story, but what is left out. Like, that's what really sparks people's imaginations. And I think that Eden of the East really did that very artfully about what they did let you know and what they didn't. And I hope that the movies don't ruin that too much.
Yeah, I'll find out. I guess I'll find out next year when they put them out. But, I mean, those 11 episodes, great, great show. It didn't, totally refreshing too, because it doesn't rely on, it's not just an assemblage of anime tropes. It just feels like a really good story being told really well, which is the essence of good entertainment. And I implore anyone who likes this show, likes this podcast and agrees with anything I've ever said about anime, watch Eden of the East. It's super, super good.
Yeah. I will second that.
Yeah, awesome. Also, I really hope that they make some kind of a toy of the dog, the little puppy. I don't know if they do or not. I don't think I've ever seen one. I don't think I've ever known to look for it, but I want a little dog.
I know they did create a replica of the phone. I don't know if they ever released anything of the dog. I'd have to look.
Those little wings. That's so great. Bamboo was actually...
They probably made those. They probably have those in Japan for dogs. Like, that probably wasn't even something they came up with for the anime. That probably already existed.
I assumed that. And Bamboo was watching the show at the same time as I was, because she was reviewing it for Shelf Life. And we were both sort of going, oh, the puppy's so cute. And she went to look for dog wings and couldn't find them.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, you can get like a Halloween costume that has wings on it and put your little dog in it. But nothing like was shown in the show. Yeah, nothing like that. She wasn't able to find it, though. I'm sure somebody listening will be like, oh, actually, it's right here. But maybe I'll... Maybe
or better
I'll...
yet, somebody who goes to anime cons, you know, they make those little foam wings now. They'll make a doggy version.
Maybe they will. And I can ask them to make bunny-sized wings.
Yes.
All right. Let's...
Bunnies that flew. No, it was cats. Never mind.
Right. All right, well, let's go ahead and get to the guest. Okay, joining me now is independent producer and co-founder at 1212 Entertainment, Joshua Long. Hey, man, thanks for coming on.
Hey, Zach, thanks for having me.
Sure, no problem. So let's just get to the obvious reason why you're on an anime podcast.
Okay.
What exactly are you guys working on over there?
Well, we obviously, I think our biggest project that people are aware of is Cowboy Bebop at 20th Century Fox. That's a project that we've been really involved in now since the very beginning. We kind of started that a couple years ago when we started to go after the rights, and now we're very far along, as I'm sure the listeners are aware of. Since then we've been acquiring other anime, manga, and actually video game properties from Japan. We've been working closely with a lot of writers and other producers in Hollywood, developing them with writers and directors, and then eventually, producing them with studios.
Right. What other project can you tell us? Some of the other titles that you currently have in development.
Sure. We're doing Kakarembo, which is with De Bonaventura Pictures, which is based on a Japanese short film animation. It's a really exciting one. We're now have a writer writing and directing team that we're close to getting attached to it, and that's very exciting because it's a very it's a small anime, and not very many people are familiar with it. But I think it's very exciting, very original, and that's exciting. Trauma Team is our TV series that we're putting together. We shot actually a presentation pilot this summer in Los Angeles. That's based off of a Japanese video game from Atlas Entertainment for the Nintendo Wii. We're also working closely with Hakusensha on an adaptation of Fruits Basket, which is very exciting for us because of such it's such a large title and such a beloved title, and we're close to assigning a writer to it now. And that's a project that's been very close to my heart. It's the project that I was pursuing along with Cowboy Bebop really at the beginning. So it's something that I hold really dear. And there's a few other ones that I can't quite mention yet that are in negotiations now with the Japanese rights holders. And hopefully by Christmas, we'll have two very big ones to also announce. But those are the ones that we're concentrating on right now.
Oh, okay. Now, I've been hearing rumors about Fruits Basket, but it sounds like maybe that's one of those you can't really talk about yet.
No, we can. I can talk about it. We're not doing any official announcement yet. Hopefully we will by the end of the year with the writer. It's just one of those things where you kind of want to wait. You mention it, fans want to know a lot more, and yeah. I'd rather wait to tell them more at the same time. But we have an extraordinary production partner with it. And a great writer that we actually just met with today on it this morning. And it's really, really exciting. It's very thrilling.
Okay, well, we can talk a little bit more about that later. But first, let's get into Cowboy Bebop. Now, where is this project right now? Because it was in the news recently.
Mm-hmm.
As in terms of Keanu saying, well, it's a $500 million script, and no one wants to take that kind of a risk right now. Is that true? What's really going on there?
I think I don't speak for him. I think I read the interview, and I think throwing around the term $500 million is more of a way to be funny. It is a very expensive movie. I mean, it's a big movie. It's certainly not $500 million. I think that was more of just a way to throw on a large number. We have an extraordinary script by Peter Craig. We are in, it's in active development. Everything is moving forward. I think people probably misinterpreted what he said, and it might have caused a little bit of a stir, but it shouldn't cause any alarm to anybody.
So it's not like now the movie isn't being made because Keanu said that.
Absolutely not. And I know that wasn't his intent. I don't speak for him, but I think, he was there doing a junket for another movie. I know he gets asked about this a lot because obviously it's a very important title, but it might have been just, don't ask me any more questions about you. I think that might have been it. So yeah,
that's Mr. Reason.
People shouldn't read into it. And it was picked up a lot in the Japanese press, and they kind of misinterpreted the $500 million phrase. That's kind of a colloquial phrase that we use when how expensive, it's $500 million, so I think it was just misinterpreted. So I wouldn't read anything into it.
Right. I think in history there's been one $500 million movie.
One $500 million movie, yeah.
that then went on to make $1 billion, so.
Exactly. I will say this. It's very the script as it's very big. I mean, it is, Bebop, hops around planets, and it's very exciting. So it is a very big movie, but it's certainly well within studio's ability to make this movie, so that's not scary.
Right, exactly. Now, so what can you tell us about the film itself? It's been mentioned that it kind of centers around the story arc of the first episode or two, with the red eye drug and Vicious and all that. That's been talked about, but I haven't actually heard anything concrete. So what can you tell us?
I have to be pretty cautious here on what I can say. But it does center around, Spike, Vicious, and Julia. It does tell that the main thematic story of the anime series. The series has lots of standalone episodes, and then they have, I think it's over seven episodes. They kind of have the story arc of Julia, Spike and Vicious, and the Red Dragon's path. And that's certainly something that we concentrate on. So
okay.
I would say it's not an origin story. It's definitely sits well within, comfortably within the anime as we know it. So it's for fans of the series. I mean, when I read it the first time, I felt so completely comfortable because I knew these characters very, very well, and Peter captured their essence and their personalities just perfectly. And so it was really, as a fan, it was really exciting for me to read it because I felt very comfortable with these characters. So what we also have to do then, as filmmakers, is to open it up to wider audiences as well. We need to make it just as inviting for them too. And so that's something we're very conscious of, is to make sure that it invites really all audiences in that might not be familiar with the characters.
So can you tell us what characters are actually in the script? Like who's in there and who's not?
All of them.
Even Ed and Ayn, they're in there?
Yes.
Really? Huh. I think the common wisdom was, nah, there's no way they're going to try and fit those characters in there.
Well, it's funny. They're comic relief, which is really necessary. I mean, for the Bebop crew is very funny. I mean, Jet is hilarious, and he doesn't mean to be, but he is. And Spike is just in his own way. But it is really those two characters that add some fun to it, because at the end of the day, it is a very lighthearted, fun adventure. It is not super serious, and I think that's what's exciting about it. And it's also very, the other character in it is the Jazz, and I think that the Jazz is still extraordinarily important because it has that tempo still, which the series did, which is, of course, Bebop is a jazz term. It was based off of that, so that's still very much present, and that's also a real character. And the ship is a great character as well. It has a personality all its own, which is fun. Kind of like the Millennium Falcon, it has all these quirks that that are exciting.
Yeah, that was actually my next question, was about tone and exactly how this was sort of approached, because the show has moments of deadly seriousness.
Yep.
Specifically the episodes you were talking about. Mm-hmm. But I think if you lose it, if you sort of get lost in the super seriousness of it and forget about the comedy aspect of it. Yeah, the movie could just be deadly boring.
it's really funny. There are some lines in it, and a lot of the humor in the anime series centered around their quest for food.
Yeah,
they're very, very bad bounty hunters. I mean, they might get the mark, I guess, but they never get the bounty, and so they're not good at it. And I think that's a lot of the humor. And there's definitely some extraordinarily funny jokes in this. And what was neat, we communicate obviously very closely with Sunrise and the creators of it. They give us notes on it, and we're creatively very, very in sync. A lot of the humor didn't translate, when we do the translation into the Japanese, so they can read it. A lot of the things that we thought were funny, they didn't understand. So it was really, it is a lot of this humor, we had to kind of explain to them in a different way, but it has that playfulness that the series did. At the same time, it is also very, very serious. I mean, there's revenge, it's betrayal, there's death. I mean, even though it takes place in space and, kind of a fantasy, it is certainly serious. I mean, these are real people. There's no aliens, so this is not that far removed. These are actually all humans, even though they might be on Mars.
Right. Yeah, Bebop didn't really have any alien characters in it that I can remember.
No.
So in terms of the cliched pitch, because everybody says, well, there's always the cliché pitch is, oh, this movie is this successful movie plus this successful movie.
Yeah.
How did what is that pitch for this movie, do you think? It's a toughie.
I'm trying to remember how I described it, because I had to do, you know, I had to do this, yeah, 2 years ago or whatever. What did I describe it as? I almost want to go back and look at my notes. Maybe I'll get back to you on that. But
that's fine.
It was, you know, it, what is nice about it is that people know Bebop, so we didn't. And there's been a lot of things that have been kind of in. We can't say it's Firefly, but better. You know, it's right. It's got to be. It's the other way around. You know, so because this was a very influential one. It was also consciously made as a Western. You know, so it was. It had a lot of Western influences into it. I can't remember what we described it as, but it is, it's unique. I'll give you a little funny story. When we first met, actually, I think it was the second time we met with, Watanabe-san and Nobumoto-san in, who are the creator and writer, the director and writer of it in Japan. Literally, they were describing when they pitched it to Sunrise the first time. And literally their pitch was bounty hunters in space. That was it. Yeah, so it was that simple, bounty hunters in space.
Interesting. Yeah, when you were talking about the tone of it, the first thing that popped into my head was The Fifth Element, in terms of being sort of a comedy, space, action, adventure kind of a thing.
The Fifth Element, I would say, is, and I don't mean this derogatorily, but that's a little farcical. I mean, it is.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, it's a little over the top. This is not over the top. There is a lot of action, obviously, but it is not crazy, and it isn't slapstick. I think The Fifth Element also kind of had, maybe that was just because of Bruce Willis, was a little bit slap. I mean, it was a little bit silly. I think it meant to be.
That's a very silly movie.
Yeah, yeah, the anime series is silly, but we don't make it silly just to be silly. I mean, it has to. I think the comedy in it has to serve a purpose, and I think it does.
Right. There's no sort of meta, sort of satirical elements. In other words,
no.
Yeah. I don't think the source material has that in it. So.
No, the source material doesn't. And in a lot of anime and manga, there is just a notion of silliness. It's in it. I mean, it's almost in every manga. Even the most serious ones always have silly moments where boys are crying and screaming, you know. And that's also in Bebop. There's a lot of those moments, but that doesn't really translate. You know, that might be fine for anime fans, but the wider public's not going to understand it. So it's not, and it's not critical. Those things aren't that important.
Yeah, yeah, totally. So from a production design standpoint, what can you tell us about the way the thing's going to look? I'm assuming, you know, there's a ton of concept art and stuff that's been drafted up.
I can't. I can't actually. We, you know, it's not, I don't think it's at that stage yet. So I'll say this, just going from the script, it is very, you know, these places are, it's Mars, but you know, these are kind of decrepit civilizations that are kind of, you know, it's our civilization that is, you know, as it had to extend out into the solar system, and it's not doing that well, you know, so it's a lot, it's pretty junky. It's very moody. It is noir, you know, kind of like, you know, obviously like the anime, but no, there isn't, let's just say there's no production designer yet. So we actually haven't nailed down into that yet, but just reflecting on the script, it is our civilization transplanted to other planets, just as we would have built them, you know, or had built them on Earth. And it's in a state of decay, just like, I think in fictionally, there's not that many people left in the world. I think they were all pretty much wiped out. And so it's kind of the stragglers of humanity that are out there. And that's why, you know, the law enforcement has turned really towards, you know, the cowboys to kind of be that last leg of law enforcement and order.
Right, right. Okay. Okay. Interesting. So it sounds like that's pretty much the long and short of what you can actually tell us about this movie.
I'm sure everybody would be very happy. And I know, you know, every producer and everybody involved in this, you know, is obviously very, very aware of, you know, the play, you know, how it fits in the fan community. And when we can share things, I know that we will, because we really like and appreciate, keeping them informed in it. And it's the only reason we're doing this. I mean, we're doing this because we care about it, and we know that a lot of other people care about it too.
Right. Okay. So, in terms of the likeliness of this thing being made, now you're an experienced producer. You know that one out of every 8 billion movies actually gets made. What do you think the, I mean, obviously you're going to tell me 100%, but what are the odds on this one? Because there's, whenever you see a project like this getting talked about the way it's being talked about, I think the general assumption is this thing is not going to see the light of day, among the fans anyway. Is that obviously?
I can't lie and say I will know that, you know, Fox, when Fox gets behind a project, they seriously get behind it, and you know they have not let up in their desire for this from day one. And it is a very long process. I mean, one of the things that this is a very big movie, and it's an important movie. So you know we have to find the right director, you know, and directors that can handle this type of movie in this scale. There's not that many of them, and they're booked. You know, I mean, they have, you know, Pirates of the Caribbean 4 to make, and they, you know, they have all these movies that are, you know, in front of this. So, you know, we need to find the right creative team. We're just not going to take any creative team, you know, so it does take time. But that said, you know, when, you know, we're all completely committed to it still, and so is the studio. So it is a very long process, and that's just unfortunately how it works. But again, I'm not a sage, but we are, you know, we're all so confident that it's going to go forward.
Do you personally have like a dream team in mind? It's okay.
Mark Forster.
Okay. Interesting.
Mark Forster. This is what we have to do. I mean, we have to conceive of, you know, a director's list and talk to directors and all that. And, what is neat about it is that there's always some great ideas that we never considered in the first place. And I know that there are, so I'm going to bet that it's a household name, at the end of the day, but there's District 9 is an example of a movie that built a director, you know, kind of from nowhere. And now he is offered everything. So it's, you know, whenever this happens, we might not yet know who that is going to be or who that right person is, because it is important to find the right person, not just the available director, but the right director.
Right. Please don't get Christopher Columbus.
Okay.
That's just from my heart.
I don't have a say in the matter.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah.
So if don't, nobody, no, I'm just kidding.
Don't blame you when it all goes south. Okay. So Trauma Team, let's talk about that.
Sure.
This seems like it is more, it's closer to production.
Yeah. Trauma Team is something that we control. It obviously it's because it's a scale that, something that we can do. We made a 20-minute presentation pilot. I mean, it's an hour long medical drama. We made a 20-minute pilot in Los Angeles. It's set in Los Angeles. It's based off that, Atlas video game. Called Trauma Team, which doesn't really have a storyline. It's on the Nintendo Wii. It's a really cool game. It's about doctors that you play certain doctors that each have a certain surgical skill. You know, so you move from trauma to orthopedic surgery to brain surgery to, you know, to heart, and you use the Nintendo Wii paddles to perform the surgery on the screen. And so it's really exciting, but it doesn't have a story. So what we did is we wanted to contemporize it. We wanted to actually create a story and take the idea of these characters and some elements of the game and actually, you know, put them to real life. So what we developed was really, it's really medical vigilantes. It's about four final year medical school students who kind of work, their residency is really in like LA's worst hospital. And they decide to kind of through the course of one night, through two students that have been kicked out a year earlier, to really form kind of a band of vigilante doctors, of really, you know, medical batmen who actually take patients that are either being underserved or misdiagnosed or, you know, can't get the surgery because of their insurance, and actually take them to a clinic that they have set up underground, actually in a warehouse in downtown, and actually fix them and bring them back. And they're completely lawless, but they have, you know, a code, and they kind of, and then they go back and exist really in the regular medical community, unbeknownst to anybody else, that they are actually this team that abducts these patients and fixes them. It's a very young, aggressive medical show. It's not ER. It's not Grey's Anatomy. It is very kind of aggressive, and they're what they're doing is illegal. but yet what they feel is what they're doing is moral and just, and their patients also see it that way. So what we find exciting about it is there's a lot of actually medical adventure as well. But we also find what's fun is to play with the real gray area about what they're doing. I mean, it goes from a gray area to a black area, but I think what they feel is that what they're doing is justified and like what Batman, you know, basically is he for good or is he for evil? Well, it depends on who you are. So, that's Trauma Team. And what we're doing now is we were just at MIPCOM with it in Cannes, which ended last week. And we are in negotiations with European networks because we're trying to do this independently with Canadian co-financiers and partners and European broadcast networks to produce a first season of 13 and then bring it into America as a completed series or a series in production.
Okay, that's got to be kind of in. I mean, surely nothing is easy in this business. Yeah. But a medical show in this environment must be an easier sell.
It's definitely an easier sell. Well, it's of a scale that we can actually make. I mean, episodes are, you know, a little over $1 million, but that's a scale that we can handle. That, you know, so we're really hands. Obviously, you know, me and my team, my company, are hands on in the production of this. You know, we produced it. We will be producing it. So it is something that's, you know, that we actually can do. It doesn't require a studio and, you know, $100 million. So that's fun. And I think, you know, if it works, I think it'll be the first, you know, Japanese property to, you know, at least video game to come over to an American TV series. And it is, you know, I was literally in Istanbul a few weeks ago meeting with the broadcast networks there, and I showed them Trauma Team. And they were like, yeah, this is fantastic. Can we make this in Turkish? You know, can we make this in Istanbul? I think it's something wherever I go and show it to people, you know, they like the American show because obviously it's very topical now to America, but it also is to their cities too, you know, and because this is a group of doctors that only serves the poor. I mean, it really only serves the people that really have nowhere else to turn. So that's relatable in any country, in any major city, anywhere in the world. So I think, you know, I mean, we have hopes for it. I think it really resonates. Medical shows do extraordinarily well internationally. House is the biggest selling, I think, broadcast show in the world right now is House. So it's certainly a genre that can be exported all around the world.
Right. And just to clarify, it'll be the first Japanese video game turned into an American television property if you don't count the Super Mario Brothers Super Show. I just wanted to point that out.
Okay. Okay. Well, then let's put a cap in the last 10 years.
Okay. There you go. Now I've played those games.
On more qualifiers.
Yeah.
First of its kind.
Now I've played those games and it's totally anime style and it's anime style silliness. Those games are ridiculous. Like what you wind up doing in those games. Are you porting that over? Do these people have superpowers? Is it going to be totally crazy?
You know, the original ones, Trauma, I think they were called Trauma Center and stuff, had some supernatural abilities. The new version, Trauma Team, they don't. They're just very good. And they're kind of prodigies in their own field. And so they each have their own individual specialty. And so we kind of carry that over. The other thing that we do, which is present in the pilot, is we actually show the surgery. I mean, we had an incredible special effects team. It is gory. And it is, we really show the surgery with an open chest cavity and everything. So what we wanted, I don't know if that's going to make it into broadcast. Well, that all depends. But what we wanted to do, at least in the presentation, is show how far we're willing to push it. So you actually, when we do the surgeries, you're actually in the perspective of the surgeon's hands. You know, for obviously it's a shortened time frame, but it actually does show it. And that's something that we wanted to kind of take over from the video game. But you're right. The silliness factor is not there. It is kind of deadly serious. But, you know, at the same time, their ambulance is a modified burrito truck, you know, so because obviously it needs to be incognito late at night in hospital parking lots. And so that's how they whisk people in and out of hospitals. And so it does have a sense of humor about it.
Interesting. Well, I'll tell you, though, if this turns out to be a big success, somebody's going to copy the formula and make it really silly.
Make it really silly.
Yeah, that's totally going to... Because, I mean, you watch medical dramas. They progress. It's like they have to up the stakes. Every new one has to have some ridiculous gimmick. And so this is sort of taking it there.
I think a lot of our medical stories are, you know, they're real. It's not like House, where they have to, you know, they have to come up with something, you know, new every. A lot of it is not necessarily the complexity of just the medical problem, but there's a lot of other things that go into the fact why these guys, why are these people the only chance, you know? And it might be something very, very simple, but it turns out that they end up being actually the one. So it's not medical mysteries, which really opens it up, which is fun. And it's very humanizing, because again, these are medical students that really could be the best of their class, but decide to really, you know, do this really for the benefit of what they see Los Angeles needs.
Right. No, it's very timely too, considering the state of health insurance in America.
Yep, exactly.
So let's talk a little bit about the industry, because you sort of, obviously, you know what you're talking about. You're involved in all these things. And what's the climate like right now in Hollywood, specifically for manga and anime adaptations?
Well, it's, you know, the climate in Hollywood, it's as tough as ever to get anything made and to get anything set up. It doesn't necessarily hurt or help that it's based off of a Japanese property that's either popular or not. I mean, the sales factors, if they're very, very big properties, you know, that helps, but that only gets you 5 minutes into the meeting. You know, you need to, what studios really want to see is they want to see the film. You need to walk into the room with the film. Mm-hmm. With a complete vision of it, including usually the filmmaker, you know, director, writer, sometimes part of the financing, you know, sometimes concept art, sometimes you need a script. So you need to do a lot of work for them. It's harder if it's based off of a property, you know, Japanese, you know, like for instance, you know, manga series, you know, they sometimes run 30 volumes and so forth. How can you condense that into, you know, 90 minutes? So it is really, really difficult. Instead of just adapting a novel, here you've got entire universes, you know, and maybe hundreds of characters and all that. So it becomes very, very difficult creatively to do it. On the business side, it does help. Source material always helps. Something proven in the marketplace always helps. It always gives you a leg up. You know, a lot of the studio people now, executives, they have nephews, they have sons, or they have daughters who have a shelf full of manga at home. They didn't have that 5 years ago. So it's certainly new to them. If they don't understand it, they have somebody in their family, they have a kid, they have a nephew, they have somebody that reads it and is passionate about it. So that certainly has changed. But it's just as hard as any movie is to get set up and made.
Right. And so there's no particular, because the common wisdom that sort of floats around fan circles is that there hasn't been a successful manga or anime adaptation yet. They've all failed. Especially like Astro Boy and especially Dragon Ball. Which were big flops, and so was Speed Racer, you know, most famously, I think. But you know what we've been hearing is that stuff doesn't really impact other projects. All they care about is the pitch that's in front of them right at the moment.
That's true. You know, if Gone with the Wind failed, would they have stopped making, you know, book adaptations? No. So we don't. It is, you know, the curse of Dragon Ball, let's just say, or something is real. I mean, it's something that's in the room. But you're right. They judge it based on the filmmaker. You know, they judge it just on the filmmaker, the source material, all that stuff. And it really doesn't, you know, genre-wise, you know, genres come in and out. Genres come in and out of favor, science fiction, what, you know, all that kind of stuff. So you do have to ride those tides. But that doesn't necessarily mean that because it's, you know, anime or manga that it's a plus or a minus. It is more difficult to adapt, let's just say. I mean, that's a fact. So it is a challenge creatively just to take these things. But what I find exciting about it, and the reason I went to Japan in the first place, is because I found something that was really, really unique. And the more time people spend over there, me, my colleagues, and other people that are over there now, you know, looking and reading a lot, find a lot more stuff. And so it's not just the franchises that make it globally that we get now. We're actually starting to see, you know, manuscripts of original novels, you know, of Japanese authors, or concepts of new manga that hasn't been published yet. So just like the book industry here, producers are starting to get, you know, closer and closer to the creators and the source material. And they're just as an original bunch of creators, writers, authors as, you know, as anywhere in the world. So that's exciting. It's going to take, you know, it'll probably take a few good solid movies based on these things to change people's perception of it. Definitely. It definitely will.
What do you think is more important? Do you think it's more important to maintain fidelity to the source material in a manner that will, in a manner that fans can sit there and sort of, we talked about this with Tim Eldred actually about adapting manga and anime into live action films. And we came up with this notion of the fans who have their checklists. Mm-hmm. So they sit there in the audience, and they're not really there to enjoy the film. They're there to make sure that it's faithful to the source material, and that's pretty much it.
Yeah.
Do you think it's important to cater to that crowd, or is the focus more like, look, let's just make a good movie, and anything else is sort of secondary?
I was on a panel with the Writers Guild last night about this with a few other producers on a lot of the subject came up. We have to make a good movie first. I think that's an overthink, but I think the source material has to be changed. I mean, if you look at One Piece, you know, which is 30 volumes, I think now or something like that, there's no possible way if you wanted to do that, you could adapt it literally. It just wouldn't work, and it shouldn't be done. You know, if it's impossible to do, it shouldn't be tried, let's just say. So you do have to change it. I think if you keep true to the characters and you keep true to the themes of what made people interested in the characters in the first place, then I think we've done our job. It's something I go through. That's my hardest job. It's also my worst fear, is to make sure that I serve both. Because I come to this as a fan of a lot of these things, but a lot of the stuff we do doesn't start as a fan of the property. It comes from another way. A writer suggested it, a director suggested it, or brought it to us, or a producer said, hey, can you help us acquire this in Japan? So I come to these properties from two different perspectives as well. And we do have to serve the largest audience possible without destroying the essence of it. There are just as many examples of super fanboy directed movies that kind of missed the mark and didn't appeal to either because they were trying too hard to be earnest. But it is a worry. But I think if you stay true to the characters and the reason why fans liked it in the first place, then we've served our job. And if they need to scrutinize it just because they want to, then there's not that much we can do about it. I think if we've served, you know, the story well.
Yeah, I think actually the ultimate example of how not to do this would be Dragon Ball. That movie was made for no one.
Yeah, I think it was made for no one. You're right. What happened, if you try to serve both camps, you end up serving none. These projects can be made cheaply. I mean, Bebop is going to be a big movie, but a lot of the stuff we're doing are smaller. They're Twilight size, $30 million or less. And there, you don't have to, it's not as important, because then you can say, well, what is the most interesting thing about this movie is this uniqueness of it, or this, and there it's a little bit easier. If it doesn't have to be as hyper-commercialized, then it's a little bit easier, I'd say, to, experiment or explore, but it does have to be changed. On the Japanese side, on the creator side, the first thing I ever say when I go into a room with a creator or editors or people who control the source material is to manage their expectations. They have to know that it will be changed, and they're always okay with that. If they trust you and they trust the producers, then they're always willing to let you go. They know we make the best live action movies in the world. They want to see it made. They want to see it made our way. So they have to trust us. But then when they do that, when they do trust and it's a good level of communication, then they're very, very open to us adapting it, because they're two totally different mediums. A 30 volume manga and a 90 minute movie are very different mediums.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Is there an example out there that you point to as like, this is how you do it? This is how you adapt something difficult like a comic or a novel series?
Well, I haven't seen it yet, but I just read a review at lunch, really, in LA Weekly, an incredible review that said, this is the classiest, I think the title was classiest, comic movie adaptation ever. And then he explained why. And so I'm really excited to see it, because I think what that had is, I guess it kept a balance of if it's fun kind of in its irreverence. So that's something I'm looking forward to. No, off the top of my head. Let me think. I'll think about it. I'll jump back in if I think of something along the way.
That's okay. I think one of the things, like, in terms of veering the other way and only serving the comic audience, I think you can point to a Watchmen as that was a great adaptation of those comics, but not for a broad audience. It was for fans of the comics who read the book a million times. And I happened to really enjoy the film, but I wouldn't. There wasn't anybody I knew that I would recommend it to that didn't also love the comic.
Yeah,
you know, it's not like I told my parents, "Hey, you should see Watchmen." You know,
what DC does really well, in comics is that they have, I don't know how many, I'm not a big American comic fan. I wasn't the kid that ever read them growing up. I'm familiar with them, but I'm not a big fan. But I know that there's, I don't know how many parallel Batman stories there are going on now. You know,
yeah.
So that's really cool that there can be one character that is told simultaneously by multiple creators, multiple writers, you know, during multiple series at the same time. But yet then when The Dark Knight comes out, it's completely different as well. And that's what I think is the power of some of these things. And I think that's the strength of having a real big body of work to work with and a real unique character, is that the filmmaker and the writer in their own right can create something wholly and uniquely new with somebody else's material. When we do that, when we look at some of these anime things, some of these properties are very broad. They have animation, they have manga, they have toys, they have video games, and they have stuff like that. A lot of times we have to tell our own story and not just take over a storyline that's already been done. We create one from scratch within the same world using the same characters. And that's what some of the major comic book franchises in America always continually to do. And they're never afraid to reinvent themselves. And that's really exciting.
Right. Very interesting. So before we get to Twitter, we said we were going to talk a little bit about Fruits Basket. Now, I know you can't say much of anything, but can you, I'm sure you can't answer this either, but what's the pitch on Fruits Basket?
I'm going to answer this diplomatically and say that it is different. It's a very exciting, you know, the Fruits Basket world is very thrilling. I think it's so wholly original. You know, its core story based on the Zodiac, and it's some, you know, that's so wholly original about it. But the manga, you know, is I think 23 volumes. A lot of stuff doesn't happen. I mean, there's a lot of pages there, but not much happens. It's really telling one story, and you know, it has lots of characters. A lot of it is about, you know, it's obviously about the love triangle. But what we're doing with it is, I will say this: the fans of it, and I became a fan of it very quickly, and I've been on YouTube and I've seen all the mashup videos, and it's really, really exciting. It is true to its core, you know, the power of love, the power of that relationship, and it expands, I say, the mythology of the Zodiac, because that's what's really interesting to it with me. We're all familiar with what the Zodiac is, but we don't know the origin story of it, and it's important, I think, for us to kind of go delve into the mythology behind it as well, to really give, the struggle a little bit more heightened sense. Fruits Basket is really kind of a silly love story, which is extraordinarily charming, and that's what draws people to it. And we want to take that obviously and explore the mythology a little bit deeper, and make it and obviously make it a little bit tighter, because you know we can't explore everything that was done within those. In those volumes, it's a great challenge, and it's a very exciting one.
Right. So, how quickly did you get studio notes asking if you could probably, you know, fit some vampires in there somewhere?
There is so much vampire manga. If they wanted a vampire manga, there's 20 good ones. You know?
Yeah.
If they wanted another vampire story, I could get them a dozen different manga titles that are good. No, we're not at that stage yet. So this okay. is still our you know, work on it creatively before we, you know, before we actually even bring it to studios.
Okay. So it's real early. This is embryonic stage here.
Well, not creatively. I mean, we've been on it for a while, just because it takes a while to, now that we have a writer that, you know, it takes a while to find the right person to do this. It's not an easy thing. I mean, the scope of the manga on the commercial side is really, really exciting. It gets everybody's attention, how popular it was. But it's difficult. You know, it's not an easy snapshot to take it into a movie. And so it has taken us creatively a while to get to the point where we're very comfortable with it to, you know, to go out.
Cool. Interesting. Well, that's going to be a source of wild speculation on part of the fans.
I will promise this to every one of those fans. They will be very, very delighted, and they can trust me in this one. I'll stake everything I have on it. This one is a very big challenge, but everything that we're doing with it is in the exact same heart of the manga and why audiences and why everybody fell in love with it in the first place.
Okay. Well, awesome.
Okay.
All right. Let's get to the questions we got for you from Twitter. Okay. From Bruce Wayne Brady. He wants to know, any chance if Yoko Kanno will contribute to the Bebop soundtrack?
I can't answer that specifically. I'll just say that because music licensing and all that stuff is different. It's not a part of what I did, but it's absolutely, the essence of it is there. So whether it's the music or whether we re-record it or do something new on it, I can't say for sure yet, but trust us, it's there. And the jazz is there and the spirit is there, completely alive.
Well, I think if you make a Cowboy Bebop movie and it doesn't have Tank in it, you failed.
Yeah, exactly. So I would be shocked if the opening credits weren't Tank. When you look at the opening credits, I mean, of the series, it's extraordinary. I mean, that's a piece of art in itself, those opening credits. So I think to use that as an entry point is just a no-brainer.
Yeah, you could use that as a pitch itself.
Absolutely.
Okay, from Jezu Otaku, she wants to know, what are the biggest changes you would see, broad changes, you would foresee needing to make to Fruits Basket in order to make it work as a film?
Oh.
You mentioned truncating the story. And
yeah, well, truncating, I think simplifying it. There is hermaphrodites. Well, I said there's hermaphrodites. There's cross-dressers. she gets orphaned and she goes lives in the woods in a tent. There's a lot of things there that don't make sense. I would say we're not contemporizing it, but we are bringing it into a modern city. So it is going to be, present in our real world. Let's just say. So there's some things that just wouldn't fit. So I'd say maybe some of the random silliness. Toru is really an exceptional character, and she is so beloved. But we need to give her a person. Putting her into a real actress is tough. You need to give that actress completely, three dimensions of character and emotion. And I think that's going to be the most critical thing for us, is being able to cast and actually give that actress the range of we need to create her in a more modern, relatable character to, kids and fans. This Toru should be everybody's friend, even though she's a reject. We want her to come across to everybody that's sitting in the audience as somebody they want to be friends with and they like and they root for. And that takes work, because it doesn't necessarily come across right away in the manga, because the manga is long and there's a lot of bouts of silliness in it. And so we need to give her a personality that's really strong.
Calling it now, Amanda Seyfried.
Okay.
Actually, if she were attached, you'd get that movie made real quick.
That's a very good choice. Thanks.
Or Emma Stone. Go with Emma Stone. Okay. Are there worries from Alex Levitt? He wants to know, are there worries in marketing that these properties are sort of 10 years out from their peak of their popularity, and a lot of fans these days haven't seen or read them? Is that a concern at all?
Well, nothing beats the Hollywood marketing machine. So if they forgot about it, then they'll certainly be reminded of it. It just because of the process of this is really, really long time, it's kind of hard to grab something in the peak of its popularity. I mean, and that's why there's no, doing it for television is very hard. The television turnaround time creatively is within 6 months. By the time it takes to close a rights deal, it might be 2 years. A lot of these things just can't happen in the moment. The other thing is that, at least with Japanese source material, I found is that when projects are in the height of their popularity, like Naruto, they're not interested in doing adaptations yet, because they don't want to bring on that extra dimension. It's still we're still in the storytelling the way it should be with the manga and the anime. Adding on this other layer is something that I think a lot of Japanese creators would like to wait until maybe their vision is done, and then to pass it off to another set of, creative talent to do a movie. So there's a lot of reasons why it can't really be instant. But I think, the nostalgia. I mean, when was Transformers? That animation was done in the 80s, and it was certainly relevant when it came back out. So,
yeah, exactly. interesting. Okay. All right.
That might be a really business oriented answer. Sorry.
No, that's totally fine. Couple of questions, which obviously you're not quite at this point yet, but people sort of want to know how in a Fruits Basket movie, theoretically, how would the transformations work? Is that something you've got floating around in your head yet?
Yeah. I think the level of CGI is so amazing now that I would say, you know, the Chronicles of Narnia was, a while ago, but I'd say the way that they, shaped those animals is a mark of how actually they personify and they come to life. That's a little bit down the road, just because what happens is, you know, we first concentrate on the story, and then a whole new set of great artists come in and do concept art, which adds a completely different dimension that us as, you know, producers never conceived of in the first place. Mm-hmm. So there might be thoughts as to how to handle this that we haven't even considered. And that's the great process of this is, you know, those are a completely different set of artists that add another layer to this that we might not conceive in the first place.
Right. Yeah, that would be interesting. And I would hope that they would go sort of the Narnia route rather than the Animal Logic route, the guys who made, like, you know, that Owl movie where they have the sort of creepily realistic faces.
No. This is, what I think it's funny is that, I think it's going to be interesting when we see the little girl, you know, transform into this big ox, you know, because these characters in the manga, you know, they take on the characteristics of their animal. And so to finally kind of see them unleashed is I think going to be really exciting. So, they'll be realistic, just because that's how I think we've always seen it. Stylized maybe, but definitely, you know, realistic, not, you know, morphed person, animal, beasts, you know?
Yeah, right. Exactly. A couple of questions from Ed Sizemore. He asks, we touched on this a little bit, but he wants to know, live action anime adaptations have yet to do well. Why do you think your films will break that trend?
Well, I'm not doing these movies to be the first or to break a trend. I mean, I was attracted to the source material, not as a novelty, but because I found something in it that was very exciting and continued to find things in it. So I really don't use that kind of as a benchmark. I don't want to be that first successful one. I mean, there's a lot of great properties in the works, Akira, Ghost in the Shell. I'm just as excited to see those as any of mine, and I hope that they work. It only helps if, you know, they do great and they're met critically with great acclaim. But I'm not doing this as, you know, to be a pioneer in anything. It was really the attraction of a source material. You know, the first five things that I ever optioned were just regular old American novels, you know, nonfiction, fiction stuff. And it wasn't until I saw Gantz that I was really, I looked at a whole new, another universe of source material.
You mentioned you're not quite here yet, but he wants to know, what costume changes can we expect for the Bebop movie? Do you actually expect to find someone willing to wear a FaZe anime outfit?
I hope so. I mean, I want to be at that casting session. No. I think if I could have found Spike's suit for Halloween, I would have done it. I've seen them at cosplay. I think I saw them at, I was at Japan Expo in Paris, and I think there was some Bebop crew. It's easy to do Spike. Jet is difficult because of his arm, but Faye is going to be an interesting challenge. So I don't know, you know, that's going to be exciting for me too. I don't know.
Yeah, I think translating that into live action, I mean, even when I see cosplayers wearing that, it's...
Yeah, there are laws of gravity that exist on real humans that don't exist on Faye.
Well, that, yeah. And the outfit is very 90s. It's very, it's very like space prostitute from 1998, you know, so it's kind of difficult. I would expect that to be changed, actually.
Yeah, absolutely.
Even though it's an iconic outfit.
I'm sure he's going to have a Jericho pistol, but I think, costume design is a whole nother...
Yeah,
challenge.
Ball of wax. Also in sort of fantasy land, because obviously you're not here yet, he asks, ideally, I guess I'll change the question a little bit. Ideally, would it be a blend of sets and CG, or would it be all blue screen, like, say, Sky Captain or Avatar? That's so far down the road, I know, but
it's down the road. But I'm just positive. You know, Bebop, again, it exists in the real world. If you can transplant kind of a rundown American city on Mars, that's kind of the world of Bebop. You know, it's dusty sombreros. I can't remember. There's a great quote about it where it's set, but it is. You know, these are civilizations that they inhabit were built by humans and using the same materials that they found on Earth and all that. So, you know, that's in the anime. Of course, they have a gate that, you know, a Stargate, but so there, obviously there's a lot of fantasy in it, but it is. I'm almost sure it's going to be a lot of practical. And definitely not a Sky Captain or, you know, Avatar. It's definitely going to be practical.
Yeah, that'd be cool. Plus, if you if you actually build the bridge of the Bebop, you can totally bring that to conventions.
absolutely. That's a great idea.
Have that set up at Comic-Con. That'd be cool. Okay, finally, from Real Car, he asks, this is a sort of a broader question, are these being launched as potential franchises? Are you only concerned with getting the first one out the door, or is the idea sequels?
Well, you always leave, I mean, when you set off to do this, you always leave, you know, room for the story to continue. I just say, I mean, that's just smart. Besides Shakespeare, you know, you can pretty much stretch any story to a sequel, let's just say. The first one has to work. I mean, you can't, what was the golden compass? You know, you can't set out to tell the first chapter and wait for the big bang at the third chapter. You know, you've got to get the first one right. So I would say it's always conceived of that they can continue, but we're not telling this. It's not going to be told in chapters that you have to wait for the third movie to pay off. It is something that, you know, we got to get the first one right. And then the door is always pretty much always open to continue.
Kind of like the Star Trek relaunch.
Even a relaunch, or even what, you know, what happened with Independence Day, if they do it again in an alternate, you know, universe with, you know, Will Smith as president. And, there's a lot of ways to, I think, do it to keep it alive and interesting. But I certainly wouldn't plan on, it's certainly not being planned on as, you know, a three-part.
Right. But at the same time, you're probably not going to kill off Spike at the end of the first movie.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Right. Okay, man. Well, that about does it. Thank you so much for your time and coming to talk to us.
Thanks, Zach. Thanks for having me.
Sure thing. All right. That's our show. I want to thank Joshua for joining us. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes. And hey, we will see you all next week.